Coming up on Weekend America.
This weekend, as waters rise in Iowa, we're flooded with memories of last year's disaster in Washington State.
We could tell it was going to come up over the bank, so we started gathering the sheep. As soon as we were done with that, the water was coming in that shed.
The Chehalis Valley, one year later. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. When Dick Weiss treated his daughter like one of the guys, he didn't hear the end of it.
I never give my girls my undivided attention because their mother puts them at the center of the universe. So we would go to a sports bar, and I'd be able to keep an eye on the game, and I would drink a beer, and she would drink a root beer.
A father and his daughters trade words and love it. And later, a psychologist explains why summer songs are so simple.
Most people aren't running around with Stravinsky in there. They're running around with Who Let the Dogs Out?
The science of summer songs on Week in America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul. This weekend, American teenagers are going to be riding with the top down, hanging out at the pool, and don't forget the summer love. And all the while, music will be playing in the background, songs that will stay with them for the rest of their lives. It's musical, it's biological, it's chemical. Later this hour, Your Brain on Music, the summer edition. Stay with us for that. What's your ultimate summer song?
It starts out like this.
That's the song right there. I mean, you can listen to it all day, every day, anywhere.
Hot town, summer in the city. Back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Cool cat looking for a kitty.
Shorty wanna bang, bottles in the club.
A lot of the kids in my class sing, I'm taking a shower. It's really hot.
I had to keep it PG. I can't see the lyrics.
I'm taking a shower. It's really hot. That's the song. Shouldn't the summer song be I Have Ice Cubes in My Bathtub? It's really cool.
There you go. Those voices came from Seattle, New York, St. Paul, Norman, Oklahoma, and Concord, New Hampshire.
Well, those floods continue in Iowa, as you heard from National Public Radio. Thousands of people forced from their homes there. The good news is the Cedar River seems to have crested. More rain is on the way this weekend, but the coming week should be sunny and dry. Iowa has been the hardest hit, but really big swaths of the Midwest are affected. The immediate concerns are drinking water, evacuations, emergency operations. Longer-term concerns are economic, the loss of crops, commercial transportation, and tourism.
Those images must be familiar to the residents of the Chehalis Valley in Washington. That's a little bit south of Seattle. On December 3rd last year, the upper Chehalis River flooded, and parts of Washington and Oregon were declared disaster areas. Trade was crippled when the West Coast main interstate was closed. The flood submerged farms, roads, bridges, entire towns. Three people died in that flood. We sent reporter Jeannie Yandel from station KUOW in Seattle back to the Chehalis River Valley. Signs of the flood still litter the landscape, but there's something else there, too.
The Chehalis River Valley in southwest Washington is full of open, green, hilly space. There are dozens of small farms dotting the valley on either side of the river. Brad and Meg Gregory bought a small farm here 17 years ago. They had a few sheep and started making cheese from the milk. In 2005, they started selling their cheese as Black Sheep Creamery. It's delicious cheese. Their fresh cheeses melt on your tongue and showcase flavors like garlic and basil. Their feta even won a national award in 2006. You can see a few of the Gregory sheep as you park in their circular dirt driveway. There's very little sign this place was decimated by a flood in early December 2007.
Water, water everywhere. That's the story in Washington State as rivers overflow their banks. Dikes designed to protect this area failed, worsening the problem.
We never did hear any warning of any kind.
That's Brad talking about the morning when the Chehalis River overflowed, higher and faster than it had in 20 years.
We could tell it was going to come up over the bank, so we started gathering the sheep. That was probably 10:30. As soon as we were done with that, the water was coming in that shed. I made one more trip, one more effort to get back to the barn somewhere around noon. And about 1:30, a boat came meandering by on the road and offered us a ride, and we said, sure, we'll take it. You know, we had to concentrate on the kids and us, and the rest we let go.
When Brad says he let go of the rest, he mostly means his sheep. Brad's family had 100 sheep before the flood. Afterwards, they had only 24. Brad and Meg didn't have flood insurance. FEMA gave the family around $20,000, but Brad estimates the damages in property and lost animals at Black Sheep Creamery exceeded $100,000. The governors of both Washington and Oregon declared states of emergency. Rescue workers spent days in the area, helping stranded families and removing the bodies of dead animals. And volunteer help started coming from all the places you'd expect, like the United Way and local churches. But other people started to come down, too. They'd eaten the Gregory's cheese or knew about black sheep in other ways, like Deb Bender, a sheep farmer outside Madison, Wisconsin. She was heartbroken.
I just can't get the thought out of my mind of seeing these sheep, not knowing, you know, if they would survive or not. It just still hurts. Losing lives is a real hard thing for anybody, but especially when you're when you really have the passion that I do with my sheep, and it's a way of life. It's not just a business.
So Deb decided to donate 10 ewes to the Gregory's. Her livestock transporter even donated the cost of his delivery. So far, 7 of the 10 ewes Deb donated are pregnant or have had babies.
There's something about this place. You know, you see the Black Sheep Creamery, and you see this old barn, and you see this home that had obviously been there for a long time. And, you know, when you get in, and there's these tiny little lambs that are so cute, you know, and we were just sort of old city folk here enjoying ourselves out in the country.
That's Jim Probert from outside Tacoma. He and his friend Bob Moore have made the hour-plus drive down to the creamery to help out most weekends since March. They worked on the Gregory's fences and vehicles, and they watched as Brad and Meg slowly started milking and selling cheese again. Bob says he goes to his local farmer's market now to buy cheese from Brad and Meg and Black Sheep Creamery.
It's kind of refreshing and knowing that we helped make this cheese. I mean, we helped get it back into operation.
6 months after the flood, there's still a lot of work left to do. The first floor of the Gregory's house still needs its floors fixed. The cheese cave, where the hard cheeses are aged, needs more cleaning. And even though Brad and Meg are still down 39 sheep, their ewes are having babies. That means more work.
We'll actually milk for quite a while longer than we normally do. We normally quit in October, and we'll be almost year-round. So we'll see if we like that or not.
Brad's joking. Of course he likes it. Despite the money, the property, and the lives lost, Brad and Meg aren't devastated. They're hopeful.
It's just awesome. We've made a lot of friends. Friends coming out of the woodwork, some that we haven't known were friends, and that have either had our cheese or heard our story. It's just been great.
In Seattle, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
You can peek at the Gregory's historic barn that survived the flood, and plus there's some really cute pictures of the lambs. Go to our website at weekendamerica.org. You know, this weekend, I hope that the people in Iowa will find that there are many strangers out there eager to help them get back on their feet again.
There was a story in Harper's about 3 years back about how before a disaster, when they're planning for it, the government prepares for the panic and the looting, mm-hmm. but that in fact people tend to show remarkable calm and graciousness to each other during times of disaster.
Yeah, it's good in these times to actually get to hear some of those stories.
You're listening to Weekend America. This weekend, researchers are focusing on tomatoes grown in Florida and Mexico as they hunt for the source of a salmonella outbreak that's made more than 200 people sick in 23 states. The strain of the disease that's causing the problems now is called Salmonella St. Paul because it was first identified in St. Paul, Minnesota in the 1940s. A writer for the St. Paul Pioneer Press complained about the disease's name, saying, "Who wants to be associated with diarrhea, fever, and abdominal cramps? Isn't Minneapolis available for that?"
Oh, man.
Tough. The fact is, naming the disease after a location happens a lot, and sometimes it can cause problems. Joining us is Dr. Larry Altman, medical correspondent for the New York Times. Larry, welcome to Weekend America.
Thank you.
Some diseases are named after places, some are not. Who decides that and how?
There's no short answer that I know of. They can be named for a geographical location, for the discoverer, for the person who first reported a disease. It can be named after patients who had it. This Christmas disease, it's mistaken for hemophilia, and people think it's because it was discovered at Christmas time, but it was named after the first sufferer, who is a young boy named Christmas. There are committees that meet and formalize the names, but they meet only every 5 or so years, and by then the names are often ingrained. I'm sure Legionnaires' disease was ingrained before committees met.
What are some other towns unlucky enough to have lent their names to diseases?
Coxsackie is one in upstate New York where the virus was isolated. Salmonella, there are hundreds of Salmonella subtypes, and many of them are named for geographical locations. You get Lyme disease for a town in Connecticut, even though the disease was known in Europe many years before. The Junin virus occurs in Argentina. You have Ebola. You have Marburg. They're all named by the scientists who discover them and give them, in essence, a scientific nickname.
What problem does it cause when a disease is named after one place, but it actually can appear lots of places?
That's a particular problem. Rocky Mountain spotted fever is a good example of that. The agent was isolated from ticks in the Rocky Mountains originally, but then it was discovered years later that the same agent was being transmitted by ticks in the east. And it gets into a situation where you think that a disease may be limited to one locale when indeed it may be much broader in terms of the areas where it occurs.
You wrote some 20 years ago that in the medical community they would talk regularly at one symposium after another. We really got to do something about this, this naming convention. I think it was Lyme disease you were writing about. Has that problem solved? Have we figured out a better way?
Not that I know of. It's still Lyme disease for that one. I think once it becomes convention, it's very hard to remove it from everyday usage. It's like anything else in life. The habit forms, and it's very difficult to undo it.
Dr. Larry Altman, thank you so much.
You're more than welcome.
Dr. Larry Altman, medical correspondent for the New York Times. Here's another example of an illness named for an unfortunate town. There was an outbreak of a bacterial infection with flu-like symptoms in 1968 in Pontiac, Michigan, when General Motors had a car-buying campaign where they encouraged people to catch Pontiac fever.
Oh, timing
so
is everything.
Yes. The bacterial infection called Pontiac fever.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
Coming up, an obscenity trial somehow turns even raunchier, and so much for Guantanamo Bay. Good news, bad news, or no news, next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. Some of what you are about to hear may shock, but when our very Constitution is under question, then we don't flinch. We call on our non-expert panel to help us decide whether the week's events are good news, bad news, or no news. Joining us this week, writer, comedian Dana Gould. Hi, Dana.
Howdy.
Author, movie maker John Ridley. Hi, John.
Howdy.
And political consultant Tara Settmeyer. Hey, Tara.
People from Jersey don't say howdy.
Our first topic. The Supreme Court ruled this week that the Guantanamo Bay prisoners have a constitutional right to challenge their detentions before a civilian judge. George Bush and John McCain say it's bad news. Barack Obama says it's good news. Are either of them right, or is this somehow no news?
This is bad news. This is a catastrophic decision. And it's a blow to the war on terror and our fight against radical Islamists and people who want to kill us. The dissenting opinions were very scathing. And I happen to agree with Justice Scalia when he said that he hopes this decision he believes that this decision will end up costing American lives. This decision extends the same rights that you and I in this country have to enemy combatants who want to kill us. And the Supreme Court, it completely disregarded its own precedent from the case in 1950. They are legislating from the bench.
Many appointed by Reagan.
I love Reagan, but everyone makes mistakes.
How is the effort to rename Earth the Ronald Reagan Memorial Spaceball going? I would say I respectfully disagree with Tara. I actually think this is good news. And there was a point in 2002 when Dick Cheney said, to fight this war, we have to move to the dark side. And I think it was part of the American sort of mass hypnosis at the time that nobody said, really? Because isn't the true victory of terrorists not that they can blow up a bus station, but that they change who we are fundamentally? I don't think you can stop anybody from blowing up a bus, but what you can do is preserve who you are and what your country stands for.
John Ridley?
I'm going to have to gently side with Tara on this one.
Really?
Look, I mean, we're at war, and you're going to capture some people, and they've got to be dealt with. And I don't think that enemy combatants deserve all the rights of American citizens. You have individuals who are crossing the border just to get jobs who are not extended the same rights as American citizens, and they don't mean us any harm, and quite frankly, they're helping the economy. So why would you extend rights to all individuals who are suspected, at least, of trying to kill us or at least kill soldiers on the battlefield? So I think, again, the Bush administration should have done a better job. Some of these folks should clearly not have been sitting there for 3 or 4 years, but there are people who are there who deserve to be there. Who are being treated a lot better than a lot of our soldiers were treated in situations like Vietnam or whatever.
At the very least, they should be granted the rights afforded prisoners of war in the Geneva Convention.
Our next topic. John McCain was asked this week if he has an estimate for when U.S. troops might leave Iraq, and he said, quote, no, but that's not too important. What's important is casualties in Iraq. McCain said American troops are in South Korea, Japan, Germany, and that's all fine. The key to it is we don't want any more Americans in harm's way. Was that assessment good news, bad news, or no news?
Unfortunately, I think that anytime John McCain speaks, it's not too important at this point because the media is so in love with Barack Obama. You know, he's the self-appointed next second coming. So, I agree with John McCain's assessment on this, and I'm no fan of his, but his stance in Iraq I happen to agree with. And, I mean, for people to try to say, for the Democrats to jump on this to say that this demonstrates he's out of touch with the war and the military families is just asinine, in my opinion, because you got to be kidding me. This guy was a POW. He was tortured for 5 years. I mean, he's on the Armed Services Committee. He's more engaged. He's been to Iraq, you know, multiple times. I think it was completely overblown by the Democrats and it backfired.
John?
First of all, McCain going to Iraq. If I could go with 100 soldiers and 3 gunships, I'd go to Iraq. I would take my family. We'd go on vacation. We'd have a good time. Mm-hmm. Stop by Bed Bath & Beyond, pick up some rugs too, and go home. So I went to Iraq thing. That's nothing. I think it's no news. I think all of it is no news. I'm not sure what he was trying to say or what point he was trying to make or why people would get upset about stating the obvious. We'd like people not hurting our troops.
I think the telling quote was from Joseph Lieberman, who said,
That sounds just like
that
him.
Was a game changer when he said that.
Joseph Lieberman has been replaced by an old iron gate.
Our next topic. There has been a sensational federal obscenity trial going on in Los Angeles, making national news. A Hollywood filmmaker claims his hardcore fetish films are art and they're protected speech.
Films are art, Bill.
The jurors,
they are art.
Be that as it may, John, the jurors were going to watch this stuff and decide. I was going to ask you about this, the moral and constitutional issues. Then a bombshell. The federal judge in the case gets caught with smut on his personal website, which he says he thought was private. Men frolicking with farm animals, women on all fours painted to look like cows. Stuff I won't describe in the middle of the day when parents listen to public radio with their children. The trial is suspended. The judiciary is scandalized. Is this good news, bad news, or no news?
I think this is bad news. We look to judges. They're supposed to be a higher authority in the law, and then they go, and how can you have it? Shows their fallibility. And you can't have hypocrites sitting presiding over cases where he has clearly a proclivity.
But my thing is, I mean, okay, so he's in the pornography. I mean, before he wasn't, we assumed he wasn't. How is that impartial? I want, you know, if I'm going to be up in front of a judge, I want to know that the guy understands pornography at least.
He knows his stuff.
Has some kind of concept of it, as opposed to is completely alien to it.
There was a huge sign right out of the gate that he was into pornography when it was revealed that he was a living human male. What I don't understand is why he kept it on the internet. Why didn't he do what I do and keep all of his porno in his shame cauldron?
You have one too,
Dana?
I have a shame cauldron beneath a false floor in my closet.
Yeah.
But you know, it's the content is key, because the point of the trial was defining obscenity. I think it was the images on his website were specifically related to the images that were on trial. Then I think you get into it's a slippery slope.
But here's the interesting thing. What you're talking about, Dana, is the old community standards.
I know it when I see it.
You know, when you see it.
Right.
They ask him about some of the things that were on his website, and he said, well, I'm not really sure if that's pornography. So here's this guy. He doesn't know it when he sees it, when he puts it up there. I have one other problem with him, too. Apparently, when this was found out, he didn't take the hit. He didn't stand up and say, yeah, it's mine, or I did it, or so what, or this makes me objective or less objective, or I'm going to remove myself. He blamed his kid.
And he said his son uploaded a bunch
of it. He said his son did, and to me, that's dirty.
The only blame you should lay on your children is farts at a birthday party.
That's the news this week. Panel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Bill.
Political consultant Tara Setmayer, comedian Dana Gould, his credits include The Simpsons. John Ridley has an NPR blog called Visible Man. His latest book, The American Way, is a graphic novel about a government-created team of superheroes.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Coming up, letters to your father. And the letters that come back on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, thanks for sharing your weekend with us. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. Well, tomorrow, the Los Angeles Lakers and the Boston Celtics square off in Game 5 of the NBA Finals. Boston is up 3-1, so they could close it out tomorrow, Sunday, at the Staples Center. Now, plenty of people are just looking at their good fortune of having a great basketball game to watch on Father's Day. And that should include Weekend America's Millie Jefferson. She's a producer with our show, and she and her dad are big Lakers fans. But they're not looking forward to what could be the last game of the finals. In fact, for them, finals time is one big downer.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Game 1 of the NBA Finals.
Hear that? It's the sound of sadness. The sound that marks the beginning of the end of basketball season.
Finally, seconds away.
Each year I wait for basketball season, like a kid waits for Christmas. It's my happy time. But it's not just my happy time. It's also my dad's.
Basketball is great because a good game puts me in a good mood.
We didn't always share our happy time. We butted heads often while I was growing up. Our disagreements started in junior high, continued in college, and lasted until I got laid off from my dot-com job and moved back home. The two of us were home together, trying to figure out what to do with ourselves. And basketball season arrived just in time, like a fairy godmother before the ball. My dad and I start getting ready for basketball season in August, monitoring the behind-the-scenes action, watching for player trades, and personnel changes. And since my dad doesn't use the internet, when I get some scoop, I have to fax him. Finally, the season starts in late October, right around my birthday. And every year without fail, my dad gives me the best present a girl could get. No, not tickets to the game. All diehards know the best seat in the house is on your own couch. Even better, NBA League Pass, a package of cable channels that allows you to watch up to 40 games per week.
When you obtain an NBA League Pass, it's a great feeling because you have something to do every day for 89 days during the regular basketball season.
With up to 12 games a night, it's easy to get overwhelmed if you don't have a strategy.
If the score is out of reach, you can switch from that game to one that's of a caliber where one team's playing great against the other.
Me? I TiVo the game I think will be the best to watch it later. And switch around looking at others. I also usually have a game playing on the laptop and one on the desktop. During basketball season, nothing else really matters.
When basketball's on, nothing else is supposed to happen.
That's my mom.
You're supposed to have basketball on, can't look at any other programs, and you have to keep the TV on basketball till all the basketball is finished.
And every single night during basketball season, I call my dad and we debrief.
Hey, Millie.
Hey, Dad, what's going on? I can't wait to call my dad after the games. Sometimes we'll even call each other right after an amazing play or bogus call.
Kobe had to jitters a little bit because his shot wasn't falling.
He looks forward to your calling so he can discuss the game and you two talk about players and positions and the stats on the players. And so that kind of stuff really interests him and he likes to discuss all of that.
And what will we do when basketball season is over, like it will be next weekend?
Suffer. That's what we do.
I feel you, Dad. We know our behavior borders on crazy, but we don't care. My boyfriend can't believe it when I'm screaming at the TV, and it seems like my mom spends most of the season alone in the bedroom. But none of that matters to me because, don't tell my dad, this isn't really about basketball. This is the way my dad and I hang out, even when we're not together. No matter our mood or how many bad decisions I make, I know he's watching. If something outrageous happens, he knows the phone will ring within seconds, and I know he'll answer. So as the finals progress, and even if my team wins, I'll be a little sad. Basketball will be over, summer will start, and we'll go back to trying to keep ourselves busy. I'll miss you, Dad, but only for a few months. In Los Angeles, I'm Millie Jefferson for Weekend America.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, this is the radio show about what's happening this weekend. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. Dick Weiss will be at home this Father's Day, waiting to see which of his three daughters will call first. His youngest just moved out, and Dick and his wife Sally are now sitting on an empty nest. He'll get phone calls on Father's Day, but in this family, the emphasis is on the written letter. As a way to keep in touch with his daughters, Dick made a proposal. Each month, he would give his kids a topic. They'd write a letter to him on that topic. He would write back. Dick wanted to know where his girls are in their lives, find out if he was doing his job right. Here's his oldest daughter, Emily, reading one of her letters.
Dear Dad, it sounded easy, but ever since I got your email, I've been trying to decide what my favorite memory of us together is. I guess the most recent was our ride over Snowmass in the hot air balloon. Before that, there was dancing to Trailer for Sale or Rent. You always used to joke to us that we needed to spend quality time with you. When I was younger, I probably rolled my eyes. But in retrospect, I loved quality time. It was the moment that I got my daddy all to myself. Maybe it was simply running an errand, having lunch, or putting up a basketball hoop. All I know is that it didn't have to be flying in a hot air balloon to be special. Love, Emily.
Emily always was a special child, being the first. Of course, they're all special. I know you're supposed to say that. And the trailer for Sale or Rent alludes to how I used to sing to her. I would sit in a rocking chair, and I would put her in the crib, and I would sing her to sleep, and I would just wail. Trailer for sale or rent. Rooms to let 50 cents. No phone, no pool, no pets. Ain't got no cigarettes. I have a terrible voice. 2 hours of pushing. And she had to listen to it. And that was sort of our theme song, and it was played at her wedding, and we danced to it. King of the Road. King of the Road.
Dear Dad, so I'm finally getting to this email thing. I would have forgotten again, but I was deleting emails in my inbox and ran across this one. Right now I'm at my friend Ryan's house watching him play chess with his roommate. Do you remember when you sent me to chess camp? Why didn't you ever support the cool hobbies I wanted to take up, like hockey and karate? Chess? Lucky for you, I still turned out pretty cool. Do you remember you used to take me to sports bars to get sodies and play foosball? Now that I think about it, it's kind of a weird thing to do with your daughter. Are you sad that I turned out to be so girly? Love, Elizabeth.
I never give my girls my undivided attention because their mother puts them at the center of the universe. So we would go to a sports bar, and I'd be able to keep an eye on the game, and hopefully she was as well. And I would drink a beer, and she would drink a root beer, and it'd be great. But at some point, the little short bobby haircut turned into long, flowing hair. She grew up to be about 5'8" or 5'10". She's really tall and lithe and beautiful and a boy magnet. I like to think that I contributed to that magnetism by giving her an understanding of who boys are and what they're like.
Dear Dad, since I was 8 years old, I've wanted to be a writer. What I really think draws me towards writing is my desire to be just like you. As a kid, I saw you as the great storyteller. As I got older, I waited with just as much eagerness and excitement to read your stories in the Post. When I began to write columns for the Globe, a lot of people would tell me that I sounded like you. I took this as the highest of compliments. I always thought that you were the original, and I was just your follower. But then I began to dig through your old things and came across Grandpa's old letters and stories. What I learned from looking through Grandpa's boxes and what I realized you've been teaching me is that all I have to be is the best writer I can be. One who cares about the integrity of her work and the people for whom she is writing for. I could not have asked for a better example to follow than you, Dad. Love, Catherine.
My dad was a television news producer. He had the best toy in the house, which was a manual Olympia typewriter, and he could make that thing sound like a machine gun. And he would write stories for the finest journals in the land. He wrote for The Atlantic. He wrote for Life magazine, for Harper's. Now, they never printed anything he wrote, but he would send them manuscripts one after another. But he got published in the local newspaper from time to time with some funny columns. You know, just like Catherine, I watched him. And I said, I want to be like my dad. There's this appreciation for, I guess, a lineage that things are handed off from one person to the next, and you hope that you're handing off the right things and not the wrong things. And Catherine picked up on that the right way, and it makes me think that after I'm gone, and of course my dad is already gone, that we will live on. We'll live on through her, we'll live on through her children and through her children's children. What can you ask for? That's life everlasting, isn't it?
Trailers for sale, rent, rooms to let 50 cents, no phone, no boo, no pets, I ain't got no cigarettes, but 2 hours of pushing broom buys a...
That's Dick Weiss and his daughters, Emily, Elizabeth, and Catherine. Dick likes to keep the girls guessing as to whom he likes best. He says he has an elaborate ranking system, and he is not afraid to let them know who is currently in the lead.
Well, this is the show about what's happening this weekend. Like in San Francisco, this weekend, it's the 2008 Robo Games. Last year, more than 3,000 people came to see the robots and their human inventors compete in races, weightlifting, and some rock'em sock'em robo smackdowns. But this year, a returning champion from Seattle has a bigger mission in mind. Reporter Jeremy Richards has the story.
Like any good superhero story, Monty Reed's journey starts with a single terrifying event. In 1983, fresh out of high school, Monty joined the Army, and he eventually secured a place with the elite Airborne Rangers. He had 38 successful jumps, but on his 39th jump, something went wrong.
We were doing a night jump. It was battalion-wide, so there's hundreds of parachutes in the air, and somebody's parachute came too close to mine, and that stole the air, so my canopy collapsed, and then I hit the ground.
At impact, Monty broke his back in several places. He then spent a year recovering at a hospital in Fort Ord, California.
And while I was in the hospital, paralyzed legs, fingers on both hands paralyzed, the doctors told me your condition is permanent and it will get worse, so get used to it.
To distract himself from the pain, Monty found solace in science fiction novels. That's when inspiration hit.
While I was in the hospital, I read Robert Heinlein's Starship Troopers. And I got so excited about the suit that he described. He called it the mechanized powered armor that allowed the soldiers to carry 2,000 pounds of equipment. And I thought I could build a scaled-down version that could just carry 170 pounds of me. Then I would be set, and I could walk again.
It turns out the doctor's prognosis was wrong. Monty had a miraculous recovery and started walking again within a month. It would take almost 10 years of rehabilitation before he was fully functional. But he was still determined to build a robotic life suit to help others. The only catch was that Monty had no experience in medicine or engineering.
Was that supposed to happen?
Well, that brass fitting wasn't supposed to fall, but...
Monty now has his robot. Sort of. Monty and his team operate out of an abandoned kung fu studio beneath a 99-cent store. There are a few scattered prototype pieces around. They look like aerobics machines hooked up to tubes and wires. Monty has now spent years studying engineering and physiology. He's also reached out to medical professionals like Dr. Steven Steens.
Hi, I'm Steven Steens. I'm an associate professor of rehabilitation medicine at the University of Washington.
Dr. Steens says that with a few more improvements, these walking robots may be able to really help people, people like him.
Well, you know, I'm sitting here in a wheelchair and paralyzed, and Monty heard that I had an interest in weight-supported ambulation and bracing, and he described to me what he wanted to build, a life suit.
Monty, do you want to fire it up?
Yeah, go ahead.
This is prototype 14, fully assembled. It's sort of a makeshift exoskeleton.
As he stands up, he'll be putting a backpack-style harness against his back.
That harness connects to a scuba tank and pneumatic systems that help move the ankle, knee, and hip joints.
We have a clamshell for holding the lower part of the leg in place. We could have spent $2,500 for some injection molding and custom design, but it worked better just to grab a hockey shin guard and strap it on with Velcro.
In the narrow room, Monty lumbers forward, then shuffles side to side.
Another step forward. So what he's doing is he's passively releasing the air as he flexes at the hips and knees. And then when he powers up, all of the cylinders raise his center of gravity.
It may not be glamorous, but it's pretty cool. They hope to get enough funding to perfect the life suits and get them in hospitals by 2010.
The future, keep in mind the future, because this is based on science fiction where we take the fiction out, is nanotech biosynthetic muscle fibers that will weave into a suit you can wear into your clothes. And that will lift you up, and it'll be unnoticeable to the untrained eye. And I expect it'll be outlawed in sporting events, too.
This weekend, the group heads to the 2008 Robo Games. But the event is really just another step toward testing and perfecting their rehabilitation technology. One step, then another step, as far as they can go. In Seattle, I'm Jeremy Richards for Weekend America.
I was totally mesmerized by a video that shows Monty demonstrating his robot. It looks kind of like a jetpack with braces for his legs, and there's lots of these crazy yellow coils all around. Check it out. Go to our website at weekendamerica.org. In Chesapeake, Virginia, my dad will be enjoying a 93-degree Father's Day. Dad, take an umbrella with you. There's going to be some thunderstorms, too. For more weather, here's Week in America's John Moe.
It may have been a little house in Independence, Kansas, but it made a big impression. Prairie Days celebrates Laura Ingalls Wilder and her family under sun in 88 with in-character storytellers, watermelon eating contest, and gunny sack races. There's a website about it, but in keeping with the times, the website is made of corn husks and operates by hand crank. All feuds can be resolved, Hillary and Barack, Godzilla and Mothra, and Hatfields and McCoys. They host a reunion festival with a tug-of-war across a river featuring descendants of the real families, all under thunder and 81 degrees. Hillary and Barack should settle things with tug-of-war. Or even better, settle things like Godzilla and Mothra did, because that would be awesome. Hot in Cross Plains, Texas, thunder in 91, so strip down to your loincloth and grab a sword. It's Barbarian Festival, celebrating Conan the Barbarian creator Robert E. Howard with live music, food, and antiques. I remember that movie. You know, they were going to make a new version, Conan the Libertarian, but Ron Paul refused to wear the loincloth. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America. Remember all the hot fun you used to have in the summertime? If not, maybe a summer song will jog your memory. Next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com.
From American Public Media, thanks for sharing your weekend with us. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. Now, summer means outdoor pool parties, barbecues, all that's wonderful if you're invited. And if not, you have to sit glumly next door and listen to all that music blaring. It seems like every summer there's always this one song that everyone's listening to. You hear it coming from the car zipping by, on TV, it's all over the radio. And before you know it, that song is rattling around in your own head all day long. Dan Levitin is a psychologist and author of the book, Your Brain on Music. And I asked Dan how a song actually does get stuck in your head.
from a memory standpoint, summer songs are special in that the way popular radio works is that they'll play, as you know, they'll play songs over and over and over again for a limited amount of time. And then when the song falls off the chart, they go to another one. And that's exactly what the brain needs for a memory cue. In other words, the way memory works is that almost everything you experience is in there. The hard part is getting it out. And what you need in a memory cue to evoke an old memory is something that's uniquely associated with a particular time and place. So a song that's played all over the summer, but only that summer, can remind you of that summer of 1980 and the people you were with and the things that you did. A song like the National Anthem or Take Me Out to the Ball Game or Happy Birthday, we sing those and hear those so often that they don't trigger particular memories.
But why is it for me that it's the songs when I was a teenager that still evoke something, even though I'm listening to the radio all the time, but it's only those high school years that really do something to me?
Around the age of 15, there's this biological shift, and your brain is no longer primarily concerned with making new connections. Instead, it tries to prune out all the unneeded ones, and the architecture of your brain is changing. It certainly doesn't mean you don't learn anything after the age of 15, but learning takes on a fundamentally different quality. Add to that all the hormones that are going through the teenage body for the first time, and those hormones make everything that happens to you seem really important. And then all of that together creates this kind of preferential memory trace for those songs.
So, Dan, what's the formula for a good summer song?
Well, you know, I think in general, a song that's going to accompany outdoor activities is going to have a faster tempo. You're not going to have a slow, lugubrious song be the hit of summer, usually. There are exceptions. When I was a teenager, the Fifth Dimension had this song called Stone Soul Picnic. You remember that one?
Absolutely.
That was kind of slow, but it had a groove to it, and it sort of felt like a hot day out by the picnic tables.
Right. I think about humidity when I hear that song. Like, you don't want to move too fast. You just want to lounge around. Yeah, and when you were talking about tempo, I'm thinking about Gwen Stefani's Holla Back Girl from maybe about 3 or 4 years ago. Literally, it's a cheerleading song, and they're clapping out the tempo of that whole song. All the girls stomp your feet like this. Few times you've been around that track, so it's not just gonna happen like that, cause it ain't no holla back girl. Ain't no holla back girl. A few times you've been around that track, so it's not just gonna happen like that, cause it ain't no. You tend to have shorter rhythms, even though the tempo's fast, the rhythms could be slow, but they tend to be sort of syncopated and more rhythmic. When I think about some summer songs, they're in my head and I don't want them to be. They are, you know, they're just like this loop that just keeps going on and on and on. How long does it take a summer song to really get contagious, like to seep into your cranium, even if you don't want it to be there?
Well, it's different for everybody, and it's different for every song. Sometimes a song will get stuck there after one listening. Sometimes it takes 50 or 100. When a song does get stuck, we call that an earworm. And scientists don't know that much about them. I mean, we know that it tends to be 15 or 20 seconds of the song that gets stuck, not the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And they tend to be relatively simple melodically and rhythmically. Most people aren't running around with Stravinsky in there. They're running around with, you know, like, Who Let the Dogs Out? Right? Or YMCA.
Or Rihanna's Umbrella. That one is in my head. It's, and I just wish it wasn't.
Now it's in mine. Thanks a lot.
Well, Dan, thank you. This has been interesting. We'll have to see what happens this summer.
I'm looking forward to it. Fancy things will never come.
How we check with some music experts to see what they predicted that the song of the summer would be. Now, Bill, you've had a chance to look at the list. What are you betting on?
No question. This summer's Holla Back Girl is Ting Ting's That's Not My Name. That's not my name. No question.
I like that a lot, but I'm going to go with the New Yorker's music critic. I think Alicia Keys' Teenage Love Affair, it's got everything. The teenage angst, it's got a good beat, and it's got a kind of a throwback back rhythm that even kids my age can relate to. So what are your favorite songs of summer and why? You got to come and tell us at weekinamerica.org. And while you're there, check out our staff's picks for their favorite songs of the summer.
That's it for this hour of American Public Media's Weekend America, Ella, 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 this Father's Day weekend. This show produced by Ben Adair, Millie Jefferson, who has her dad's penchant for napping when stressed out, Julia Barton, Jim Gates, Ia Kobe, who's got her father's suspicion of authority, Philip Stearns, Sam Keenan, Christina Pena, got her dad's wild curly hair, Michael Rayfield, Tim Bomba, and Angela Kim.
Also Rob Byers, Susie Lechtenberg, who shares her third grade bathroom humor with her dad, Brendan Newnham, who inherited his dad's zeal for fairness and love of martinis, Michael May, David Banks, Phyllis Owens, John Moe, Mark Sanchez is cursed with his dad's laugh, but he's blessed with his dad's barbecue skills.
And Chrissy Clark, too. Galactic created our theme music. Our executive producer's Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. Get a podcast of it at weekendamerica.org. Dad, thank you for my daughter's middle name. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Dad, thanks for my love of travel and the greater love of home. Happy Father's Day.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, this is Bill Radke, host of Weekend America. The weekend is when you have time to explore your own story.
I felt ashamed to have a history book that only had a couple of pictures of African Americans who were slaves. They looked poor, they looked downtrodden, they looked miserable.
Your weekend, your story. Join us for the next Weekend America.